suicide out of the UK. They're saying for every individual that dies by suicide, 135 people were affected. That's a large number. So we think about gambling here. When someone is experiencing gambling-related harms, we absolutely know at minimum the family is affected, the friend group is affected, and possibly, maybe some coworkers or work-related individuals or even employment opportunities could be affected. The financial devastation is absolutely number one for many people. That's what gets everybody's attention. That's what people measure almost in terms of severity sometimes. The mental, absolutely mental health related issues. Many, many people are so depressed because of that dopamine crash, as well as the shame and the embarrassment of what has happened. And they think that there's something morally wrong with them because they were supposed to be able to stop or control it. And that's a myth, right? The brain is hijacked just like it is with chemicals, and people can't control. It's almost like they never took care of the brakes on their car, so they don't have brakes when they're ready to stop. Right, so it just keeps going. So there's many areas that are affected to a lesser or greater degree. It just depends on the individual, how long they've been gambling, how compulsively they've been gambling, and what access to funds do they have. Ultimately, we really want to help people before it gets too severe, because for many, they will commit crimes at some point to continue to gamble. They don't mean to commit crimes. They're quote, borrowing from someone when really they're stealing from someone. We call it gambling motivated crime because they're completely motivated to do something or cross the line just to keep gambling in hopes that they will win and recover all their losses, which never happens, and they just keep getting further and further in the hole.
Yeah, it seems pretty dire. This is a pretty big problem in America today. To wrap us up for the episode, is there anything that us regular people can do to help combat the problem?
Yeah, I love when people ask me that question when I'm interviewed. Have the conversation is what I will tell everyone. Talk to your friends, talk to your siblings, like openly talk about gambling. Don't make it a taboo conversation. And literally feel confident enough if you see a friend or a loved one that you really believe is gambling more at risk or very risky, say something. You don't know how much they might be crumbling on the inside, and they're just waiting for at least one person to say, I'm here for you. Let's get help together. What do you need? So have the conversation is the best way to break the stigma and end the silence.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for joining us today on Forbes Avenue, Jody. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM with Jody Bechtold, the CEO of the Better Institute and a globally recognized expert in gambling addiction. Thanks for listening.
Dr. Oscar Radoli, bringing you the best mix of music.
listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Right at the beginning of the pandemic, actually. And so this would have been right around March or April. And I had a portfolio of predominantly African-American businesses. And we already knew data that a lot of Black people broadly were unbanked or underbanked. So they didn't have the kinds of relationships to these banking and institutions and financial institutions. So the idea that they would be able to make it in a, you know, closing down for a week, let alone some untold amount of time, was terrifying as a prospect for me and certainly for all of the businesses in my portfolio.
Jessica Norwood, financial activist, investor, social entrepreneur, founder, and CEO of Wenway Project, and author of Believe in You Money, What Would It Look Like If the Economy Loved Black People, published by BK Publishers. Owning a business is one of the best ways to build wealth, but entrepreneurs need capital, and investing in African-American companies is instructed by systematic injustices that trace back to our nation's dark history of enslavement and discriminatory policies that continue to create barriers to success. African-American founders are denied business loans 2 times more than any other group and receive just 2% in venture capital. In her book, Believe in You Money, Nora presents a guide on how entrepreneurs of color can be supported in sustainable ways and offer a shift in the way we think about who can be an investor while changing our personal relationship with money. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Believe in You Money with Jessica Norwood in Black America.
You know, I think it's a popular notion that, you know, in order to be successful in business that you've had to suffer, you've got to grind. It has to be the most painful, excruciating experience ever known. And this idea that, you know, oh, well, you're supposed to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Never mind. You don't have the boot, you don't have the straps, the whole sort of metaphor falls apart. But mostly I kept thinking about the, when you can't use this bootstrap idea, right? Then how do you get to this American dream? Because I feel like a lot of people have been holding out hope that there's a pathway, a real viable pathway to this American dream. And I think of Langston Hughes' poem, A Dream Deferred, and what happens when a dream is deferred.
As founder of Wenway Project, Jessica Norwood is on a mission to change the way we invest and support African-American entrepreneurs. African-American businesses have 3 areas where they face challenges: access to capital, access to business support, and access to marketplaces. It doesn't matter what city, these are going to be the same. Since its founding in 2017, Wenway has supported the distribution of $3.3 million in holistic repair center funding to more than 50 businesses in California and Massachusetts that have since generated $15 million in revenue. In her book, Believe in You Money, Norwood has provided a set of principles that provide an alternative approach to business capital. Also, it's a guide on how African-American entrepreneurs can be supported in sustainable ways and offer a shift in the way we think about who can be investors while aiming to change our personal relationship with money. Recently in Black America spoke with Jessica Norwood.
I am from Alabama, from the Gulf Coast. I am from a little bedroom community of Mobile right next door called Pritchard, Alabama. Mm-hmm. And it's got about, 25,000 people there. And I come from a family of elected officials. So my dad was the mayor in that city and my cousin was the mayor in Mobile. And so political and Black and on the Gulf Coast and Alabama, all of those things.
So what sparked that interest in finance?
Yeah, I think coming from a place like Alabama has been a real defining part of who I am, and seeing my father and my family members be in elected office. And I thought, you know, these are really talented people in my city, and very much like folks who are listening out thinking about their communities. There's some really smart and talented folks. And yet I wasn't seeing the kind of investment that I thought should be happening in our communities. And I wanted to know why. And I'm one of those folks who believes to, you know, whom much is given, much is expected. And I felt like, you know, this is the community that has invested in me. They've given me the best they could. And it's my responsibility to learn as much as I can about how do we bring the money into the places and give it to the people that really need it and have really brilliant ideas for how to make our communities rich and vibrant. And so that's how I got into it, trying to understand where these gaps were in financing and following that path of, I think, what a lot of civil rights leaders were thinking of, which is what's that economic justice conversation today?
When did you come up with the thought that the book you've just written needed to be wrote?
That's a great question. I was right at the beginning of the pandemic, actually. And so this would have been right around March or April. And I had a portfolio of predominantly African-American businesses. And we already knew data that a lot of Black people broadly were unbanked or underbanked. So they didn't have the kinds of relationships to these banking and institutions and financial institutions. So the idea that they would be able to make it in a, you know, closing down for a week, let alone some untold amount of time, was terrifying as a prospect for me and certainly for all of the businesses in my portfolio. And so I was a fellow at the Center for Economic Democracy at that time, and all of the fellows were invited to do a public phone call. And we were asked this question that comes from Grace Lee Boggs. And it's a question that's very rich and juicy. And it goes like this. What time is it on the world clock? That's what they asked me. They said, what time is it on the world clock? And the other fellow started talking about this. But remember, I'm holding on to the fact that I've got Black folks in my business portfolio. They already don't have relationships to banks and finance. So they don't have money available. And when it came around to me to answer the question of what time does it look like on the world clock, I answered the question with a question. And I said, well, what does it look like when the economy loves Black people? Because that's what time it is. And that question started to like bubble up in circles and spaces around. And I felt like after seeing the horrific and brutal murders of George Floyd and these, you know, corporate giants starting to say they cared about Black businesses and they cared about the economic viability of our communities and making these pledges, I was curious if they even knew what that meant and how to do that. And so I decided I needed to write the book. I needed to write a book that really explained what it means to put money into people where you believe in them and to do it from a place where you are really trying to answer that question of what it looks like when the economy loves Black people.
I'm always interested in authors and want to know how they get to the point of what they address first in their book. And yours is very interesting. You said no more bootstraps. Why start there?
You know, I think it's a popular notion that, you know, in order to be successful in business, that you've had to suffer, you've got to grind. It has to be the most painful, excruciating experience ever known. And this idea that, you know, oh, well, you're supposed to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Never mind. You don't have the boot. You don't have the straps. The whole sort of metaphor falls apart. But mostly I kept thinking about the when you can't use this bootstrap idea, right? Then how do you get to this American dream? Because I feel like a lot of people have been holding out hope that there's a pathway, a real viable pathway to this American dream. And I think of Langston Hughes' poem, A Dream Deferred, and what happens when a dream is deferred. And I look at our communities and I think, aha, this is what happens. I look at voter turnout or apathy and I think, aha, this is what happens. And so I was really compelled to say, let's put aside this idea that this is a solo effort. Let's put aside this idea that people are actually even resourced to start the way that they need to start. And let's talk about what the foundation of these ideas are all about and why they aren't working for Black founders and other founders of color who've been historically marginalized. Let's talk about that and let's do something about it. Because if we don't, then we will keep saying these set of instructions as if they're benign, and they're not. And it sets people up for huge failure along that road to entrepreneurship.
Obviously, you had a front row seat with your mom and her business, but she wasn't able, to my understanding, to take it to the next level for the lack of finance. How did that experience affect you as you moved on in your career?
Yeah, right at the time I was starting my work with Runway, where I do my investment work, as soon as I made that announcement that, okay, I've got a theory of change and a strategy I want to work on, my mom called me and told me that she had pancreatic cancer. And you have ever kind of jumped out there and, you know, you're in the media, you're talking about this idea. And I had to kind of go quiet when a lot of the buzz was starting to build around my work and focus in a lot on my mother. And during that time of starting this investment strategy with Runway and also closing out the life of my mom, it really was this juxtaposition of thinking about her life as an entrepreneur, my life as an entrepreneur, and what I would have wanted her to have had when she was on her journey as a young woman in educational technology in Chicago, and what I would want for other people who are also growing fantastic businesses to have experienced. And so she became a guiding light for me and a reminder of the things that at the end of the day, when she, you know, took her last breaths and talked to me about her business and what relationship she wanted me to take care of, and all the things that I needed to do as the daughter closing out my mom's business and life, I just got a much simpler understanding about people who are in business and entrepreneurs, and mostly they just really want to take care of the people who their customers, their community. They really want to do a good job with the service that they've put out. And I think that kind of thing, that kind of love really matters. And so I wanted to center and ground my book in that kind of love for each other as really the inspiration.
I found it interesting when you wrote, and we're still in the introduction, listeners, that for the lack of capital does not mean the lack of ideas, and for the lack of capital, those ideas never come to fruition. Looking at that statement in which you wrote, why is that an important statement to make, considering that a lot of businesses don't get off the ground for the lack of securing finance?
Yeah. You know, I think sometimes I wanted to give everybody the truth and the information, because we will, as business owners, as entrepreneurs, particularly entrepreneurs of color, Black founders, we'll blame ourselves and we'll start to imagine that there's some deficit in us, that there's something wrong with our business idea, or that there's something wrong with who we are. And we'll spend enormous amounts of money and time working on something that isn't actually your fault. And so I wanted to talk about the idea that just because there is a lack of money does not mean there's a lack of ideas and a lack of innovation and imagination. And in fact, it has been our imagination and our innovation that has been a salve, has been a balm for us. It's helped us to heal and to keep going. It's given us the fortitude and the strength to survive a thing. And so, you know, when I'm thinking about what is a good investment, a history of people who have that kind of success and being innovators is a fantastic place to start. But I don't want people to imagine and attach their worth or value to the fact that a system around us that's financing does not see and appreciate that those ideas and that imagination and innovation that comes out of our communities.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment.
Hey, my name's Elizabeth McQueen, and I manage the podcasts at KUT and KUTX. The podcast you're listening to is produced at a public radio station. What does that mean? Well, that means that most of our funding comes from our community and listeners like you. So if you like this podcast, then please consider donating at supportthispodcast.org. As a thank you for your gift of any amount, we'll send you our brand new podcast sticker pack. Plus, you'll know that you're directly responsible for making sure we can make podcasts like this. Just head to supportthispodcast.org and thank you.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we speak with Jessica Norwood, social entrepreneur, financial activist, CEO and founder of Runway and author of Believe in You Money. What would it look like if the economy loved black people? Ms. Norwood, how did you come up with the term Believe in You Money?
This was a funny one. It was a little by accident, but I don't know if the listeners can tell you. I can get on a preaching sermon in a minute. And I was at a conference in, I believe, Cincinnati, and I was doing a keynote address, and I was talking about businesses in Cincinnati and this opportunity. And I said, listen, I'm not talking about impact investing, because that was the language du jour of the day. I'm not talking about impact investing. I'm talking about believe in you money, money that believes in your abilities, money that sees you, values you, and wants to see your communities grow. And putting that as a first point or a strategy around the kind of money, money that believes in you. It also understands believe in you money that, you know, success also comes with moments of failures. You don't know how to win unless you've lost at some point. And so it also recognizes that mistakes and pivoting and challenges and all of those things are welcomed. We still believe in you, even if it doesn't all the way work out. Now, we obviously want to make, you know, do well on our investments, but we absolutely understand life be lifin'. And so we want to say to folks, we see the fullness of you and we appreciate the fullness of you, just like we want you to see the and appreciate the fullness of us as investors. And that's how we break down some of that transactional relationships that tend to happen when we're moving money to businesses. But when we start from believing in one another, we recognize that we have the resources and the ability to solve every problem that we have facing us if we shift into that abundance framework.
You talk a lot about women entrepreneurs in your book. Is there a special gene or something that women have to want them to become entrepreneurs?
Know if it's a special gene. I don't know if it's a special gene or not. But you know what I will say? You know, the data talks about that Black women are creating businesses mm-hmm. at, you know, rapid rates, faster than any other demographic.
Right.
And when I talk to Black women who are starting their businesses, what they tend to tell me is that they do it because they're looking for more flexibility in their schedules and more freedom. And that's because they happen to be more times than not the caregivers in their families, whether it's caring for elderly or older parents or for younger children. The ability to have some flexibility and spaciousness in their schedule really matters. And I think it runs alongside the fact that they also have achieved a high level of educational degrees and experiences. So you've got a group of people who have an enormous amount of, you know, personal responsibilities that they have to manage, and they are exceptionally smart. And so they find themselves moving into consultancy or starting a business, and they do so because the current corporate structures don't necessarily allow for that kind of flexibility or don't value the innovations and ideas that they bring to the table and the education that they have on the subject matters. And so they quietly get pushed out and pushed along into entrepreneurship.
Talk to us about non-traditional ways to invest and finance businesses.
Yeah, I like to think of the first way that I would want people to think of this is that we often talk about business finance from debt. So you take out a loan or you get equity. So we hear things like venture capital or money that an angel investor does. And something that we do differently with my investing is we do what's called integrated capital or blended capital. And that's where we bring philanthropic dollars, so foundation grant dollars, together with those other kinds of investment dollars. And the reason we do it that way is because at different points of time for a business, it needs different types of money. Maybe when you're just getting started, you don't have the revenue coming in to manage a debt load, but maybe a grant or some, you know, money like that would be more appropriate. Or maybe you've got a business where it's going to take off, you know, it's a tech business and we can see that, you know, horizon. Then we might say, you know, let's do equity, but we don't want your equity table to get crowded. So we might say we'll do a venture debt or something like that. So the idea and ability to be flexible and to bring all kinds of money into a deal at different points in time is a part of that idea. The other things that are important is that it's non-extractive. And it's a huge principle inside of Believe in You Money. And non-extractive means that there's never a moment in time where we are positioning ourselves to take over anybody's business. That's not what it means to believe in somebody. We believe in your ideas, and we think that there's a way that we can, you know, get paid back and do the things that we want to continue to do with our business without taking over somebody else's IP and taking over their business or their dreams. And so we're thinking of non-extractive terms. So the term sheets start to read like that. We're also thinking and measuring things around the well-being of the entrepreneur. Are you paying yourself? So before you start paying us back, we want to make sure that, okay, are the bills getting paid here? Because if not, then we need to figure out how to make this business be successful, and then we get ourselves in position. So the approach that we take around how we put our money out is much more holistic and much more appreciative of where the business is in the different stages and the different stages of life that that entrepreneur is in. And that this really is about repair. This is about repairing the fact that those monies were never available. And now we have a compounding issue where capital over and over and over again hasn't been available, or the legacy of our businesses have been, you know, completely bulldozed and taken away from us. And so we don't have information. We don't have legacy businesses to build off of. And so what's the kind of money that has to acknowledge the historical factors?
I guess the big elephant in the room, what does your vision of an economy that loves Black people?
I think it's Believe in You Money happening in every single community. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a baseline of what we're doing, that we stop saying to Black founders and other founders that have been marginalized that it's their fault, or that they have to jump through some other hoop or do something more extraordinary for a failed system. And that we have to stop prioritizing the capital and the capital holders and shift our responsibility and prioritization to those businesses and to those communities. And that when we talk about and we evoke the idea of we want to invest in communities of color or Black communities or any phraseology like that, we immediately jump to, because we're investing in those communities, we know that there has been historic harm and marginalization, and therefore they must begin with Believe in You Money. That's what I expect and hope comes out of this.
I had another aha moment when I got to the point of talking about secret money. Why was that important to articulate?
Yeah, there's a point in the book where I do talk about secrecy and in money. And, you know, a lot of this from, if you can imagine, from both different directions, there's a lot of stuff that we're just not telling each other about. Who's mm-hmm. getting the money, who's not getting the money, how the money is working. And this level of secrecy and complexity adds more stress to an already very fragile, you know, relationship around getting money for your businesses. And so one of the central parts that we're talking about here is to really let go of secrecy, to let go of some of the shame and some of the blame that we have maybe personally when it's time for us to talk about financing our businesses. We don't want to talk about some of the places where we haven't been so great, you know, managing the money in our business, where it might have been held together with a little bit of duct tape and bubble gum and so forth. We might not want to talk about, you know, some purchases or some things that we didn't do and manage so well earlier in our lives or so forth. And then on the other side, the folks who have a lot of money, the shame and blame that they feel to be inheritors of money that they didn't earn, that they didn't work for, and in fact was stolen off of the labor and extraction of land and natural resources, they feel blame and their secrecy about where their money comes from. And so the more that we start to acknowledge that there are money stories that are happening here, and these stories are shaping our ability to get to this truth, to get to this kind of believe in you money, the more we acknowledge that, the more we can do something with that information and not let it stop us from actually achieving this goal.
Talk to us about the black tax.
Oh, yeah, the good old black tax. You know, the black tax is like, you know, you got to work 1,000 times harder. You got to be 1,000 times more excellent. But also it shows up in finance and particularly with starting a business, where black businesses actually are spending about $250,000 more than their white counterparts just to get the same equal starting. Mm-hmm. And they're spending that money on higher interest rates on the loans that they're getting. They're spending that money getting coaches and mentors to just give them the information that maybe somebody else casually grew up around and heard in passing. They're spending money to try to get themselves in the room by going to conferences and so forth. And so all of those things add an extra burden. That's the black tax, the burden that it takes to actually try to do the same things that other folks are doing, but nobody wants to acknowledge the extra labor, the extra emotional angst that happens, and the extra money that it costs to perform.
In your opinion, why has Runway been successful thus far?
Why has Runway been successful so far? You know, I think it has a lot to do with not being interested. This is not being super interested in being a financial, you know, business, but more interested in solving the problem for Black founders. And this is a slight, you know, difference, but our focus isn't on the finance as a business model, but more around how we solve an injustice. And so our approach and our entry into this is actually framed very differently. We start off from a place of really honoring our ancestors, honoring our culture, and honoring what it means for Black people to talk about and celebrate wealth building.
Jessica Norwood, author of Believe in You Money, What Would It Look Like If the Economy Loved Black People? If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You're going to hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712.
That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Support comes from Austin Water. Residents and businesses can take steps now to prepare for the possibility of severe and freezing temperatures by having emergency supplies like water and insulation for pipes. More winter preparedness tips at austinwater.org.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
It's so, so very important. I can't imagine any course of study that would be more important, for it's the story of human history and humankind, and if we're going to go forward, we have to know where we've been. Now, there's no such thing as making a significant stride forward without knowing what the pitfalls are and what the dangers are, what problems might beset you, and I think that history can help us understand those pitfalls and problems, and I've sought to teach that in my courses and in my writings.
The late Dr. John Hope Franklin. Franklin was the James B. Duke Professor Emeritus of History, and for 7 years was professor of legal history in the law school at Duke University. A native of Oklahoma and a graduate of Fisk University, he received the MA and PhD degrees in history from Harvard University. He taught at some of the most prestigious institutions, including Fisk, St. Augustine College, North Carolina Central University, and Howard University. In 1956, he went to Brooklyn College as chairman of the Department of History. And in 1964, he joined the faculty of the University of Chicago, serving as chairman of the History Department from 1967 to 1970. At the University of Chicago, he was the John Mathis Manley Distinguished Service Professor from 1969 to 1982, when he became Professor Emeritus. During the Civil Rights era, Franklin helped prepare the landmark Supreme Court case for Brown v. Board of Education. And in 1965, he marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Montgomery, Alabama. On March 25, 2009, Franklin died of congestive heart failure. He was 94. I'm John L. Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to the late Dr. John Hope Franklin, In Black America.
I give you that as a background to the next experience I had in Ithaca. As the summer drew to a close, I received a call from Thurgood Marshall. I had known Thurgood for a number of years, since 1948, when I worked with him in the successful effort to open the University of Kentucky. The case of Lyman Johnson against the University of Kentucky is not cited very often. People speak of sweat, they speak of gains, they speak of the cases that arose in Oklahoma, the Sipule case and the McLaurin case. They don't speak of this case. Perhaps it is because Lyman Johnson, a graduate of the Kentucky State College for Negroes, applied to do graduate work in history at the University of Kentucky. This was 2 years before Sweat against Painter.
The late John Hope Franklin was a prolific scholar of African-American history who profoundly influenced thinking about slavery and Reconstruction. During a career of scholarship, teaching, and advocacy that spanned more than 60 years, he was deeply involved in the debate that helped reshape America's racial identity, working with the likes of W.E.B. Du Bois, Thurgood Marshall, Carter G. Woodson, and other legends of the 20th century. Franklin broke numerous color barriers. He was the first African-American department chair at a predominantly white institution, Brooklyn College, the first African-American professor to hold an endowed chair at Duke University, and the first African-American president of the American Historical Association. Born on January 2, 1915, in an all-black town in Oklahoma, he wasn't content to sit on the sidelines while African Americans struggled for equality. He marched on Selma. He met with presidents. He consulted with the attorneys who would argue Brown v. Board of Education in the U.S. Supreme Court. With his help, they were able to convince the justices that separate was inherently unequal. As an African American, he lived the history he documented, from Jim Crow to the election of the first African American president. Franklin also believed, however, that even as they study the past, historians have a role to play in shaping the future. Franklin left a profound legacy rooted in hope. In April 2004, In Black America spoke with this noted historian.
Well, I was born in a village that had a very few people in it, maybe 100 or so. And I lived there until I was 6 years old, until I was 10 years old. My mother was a school teacher. My father was a lawyer. They soon found that he couldn't make a decent living in a small town like that. And so he went to Tulsa in 1921 to open a law office there. And we were to follow him as soon as school was out. But at the end of the term, that is on the 1st of June, 1921, when we were waiting for him to come and get us to move us to Tulsa, he didn't come. And we waited several days and he didn't come. My mother then read in the newspaper that there was a race riot in Tulsa. There were many casualties, and we feared that something might have happened to him. Shortly thereafter, we got a letter from him in which he said he was not harmed, but he had been seized and put in detention shortly after the riot began, and that's why we hadn't heard from him. And when he got out of detention, he went back to where he had a house and where his office also was located in the same area. And it was all flattened to the ground. He lost everything that he had except the things on his back. He didn't have any change of clothes or anything. And his office had been destroyed by the rioters. So we learned what terror was fairly early. And it meant, of course, that he couldn't have us come there then. He didn't have anywhere to put us or anything. He came to see us shortly after that and told us that he couldn't move us then. He was very busy trying to recoup the losses, as well as suing the city and the state and the insurance companies for the losses of his clients. Those suits were, of course, to no avail. The courts paid no attention to his suits. So we stayed in that village until I was 10, which of course meant that educational opportunities were limited. My mother supplemented what was in the school with her teaching us at home. And when we finally moved to Tulsa and rejoined my father, who had come down visiting periodically, we went to Tulsa in 1925, in December 1925. I entered the seventh grade then. I was 10 years old in the seventh grade. And I graduated from high school right there in Tulsa as a valedictorian of the high school class, and where I was actively engaged in planning to go to college and then to go to law school, come back and help my father in his law practice. I would, with my additional knowledge and my initiative, I thought I could build it up and we could become a big law firm. But in college, I went to Fisk University. I ran into a white professor at college who was the chairman of the history department and a professor. I heard him lecture, and he was a very young, vigorous man, just not in his late 20s. And I was so impressed with him that I decided to major in history.
How did you get to Fisk? Why did you select Fisk?
My brother had gone to Fisk, and I admired him. I wouldn't do anything my brother would do. My mother and father had both gone to school in Nashville, Tennessee, where Fisk University was located, but they went to Roger Williams University, which no longer existed. And they thought it was a good idea for me to go to school in Nashville, and I thought it was a wonderful idea to go to school where my brother had gone, so I chose Fisk.
And from Fisk, you attended Harvard?
I went to Harvard University Graduate School in 1935 at the age of 20. We were still in dire poverty, and the depression had come, and my father was broke. And my young white professor borrowed the money in Nashville, Tennessee from a bank and lent it to me and said that money will not keep you out of Harvard. And so I had been admitted to Harvard, and I went on to graduate school there in the fall of 1935. I had to work hard there, as I had done in Nashville. And Fisk, I had two jobs in Fisk, and I had two jobs in Harvard. I was washing dishes at one of the clubs for my evening meal, which was really a great, great remuneration. I couldn't have paid for the kind of wonderful food I got there. Then I was typing dissertations for people at Harvard, and I made my way that way with the money I'd borrowed and a little money my father could send me. So I made it through the first year, after which I had fellowships, and I didn't have any financial problems after my first year.
Were there other African Americans at Harvard when you attended?
There were very few. There were two in the English department, two in the biology department, three in the law school, and there were none in any of my classes, none in the history department, and there were none in the medical school, none in the business school, none in the school of education. Just a few, less than 20.
When you studied history at Harvard on a graduate level, give us an idea of the coursework that was involved.
Well, my first year at Harvard, I took a survey course in American intellectual history. I took a survey course in world economic history, and I had a seminar in American intellectual history. I later took world economic history, and I later took American diplomatic history, and took a history of the West, and I took medieval English constitutional history also. Those are the principal courses that I took. I specialized in American history since 1789. In preparation for my oral exams for the PhD, I had British history, American history, and early American history and later American history, and history of the West. And I passed my orals in the spring of 1938, in the spring of 1939, and then began to work on my PhD dissertation, which was on free Negroes in North Carolina. And I went to North Carolina to do my research, and I worked there in the spring and summer of 1939. Broke the back of my research, got a job teaching at St. Augustine's College in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I did research and taught a full program there in 39 and 40. And I got married in 41 to my college girlfriend, and in 1940 I got married, and in 1941 I finished my PhD and got my degree.
Why did you select as your dissertation Free Negroes in North Carolina?
Well, it was the process of elimination. At first I wanted to do British history, but I didn't think I'd ever have a chance to go to Britain, and one would have to go to England to do any kind of fundamental research in British history. And in 1935, England looked about as far as Mars or Venus or the moon, and so that was not practical. And then I wanted to do work in the field of American social history. I wanted to do work on the the social gospel crowd. But I learned that someone was already working on that. And I had worked, Professor Curry, this white man at Fisk, had encouraged me to work on free Negroes, and I had written a paper, even when I was a senior at Fisk, on free Negroes in the antebellum South. And I remembered that, and I was fascinated by it. And after that process of elimination of these other two areas in which I was interested in doing work, the free Negroes in the antebellum period appealed to me. And that's how I happened to dig up the paper that I wrote when I was in college. And I said, this could be expanded on, and that's what I did.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support comes from Austin Water. Residents and businesses can take steps now to prepare for the possibility of severe and freezing temperatures by having emergency supplies like water and insulation for pipes. More winter preparedness tips at austinwater.org.
And now back to this episode of In Black America.
In your opinion, why is the study of history an important academic subject to enjoy oneself with?
Well, it's so very important. I can't imagine any course of study that would be more important, for it's the story of human history and humankind, if we're going to go forward, we have to know where we've been. There's no such thing as making a significant stride forward without knowing what the pitfalls are and what the dangers are, what problems might beset you, and I think that history can help us understand those pitfalls and problems, and I've sought to teach that in my courses and in my writings.
Are we doing a better job of inclusiveness in the history in which we teach our young people today?
I think we might be doing a slightly better job, but we're not doing the best job we can do. We're not nearly as inclusive as we should be. And the result is that we think of the United States largely in terms of groups, separate groups of people. And as a world, we think largely in terms of small nations or little nations or parts of the world. We can't integrate the history of the world any more than we can integrate the history of the United States. And until we do, we are doomed to look at ourselves in segments, look at the world in pieces, and therefore not have a grasp of our whole community, our whole nation, or our whole world.
Are there any other individuals that were mentors to you in the development of who John Hope Franklin is today?
Well, there were. My mother and father were, of course, my greatest mentors. I was fortunate to have an educated mother and father. And they of course, were my greatest tutors until I got to college. In college, not only was Professor Currier a very important mentor of mine, but Professor Lorenzo Turner, who taught me freshman English, was important. Several others, E. Franklin Frazier was in sociology and so forth. But in addition to that, I had people at Harvard. My great mentor there was Arthur Schlesinger Sr., who was one of the senior people in the Department of History. And Paul Buck, on whom I wrote my dissertation, was a very careful guide and teacher and mentor. And I fancied myself also as having mentors whom I didn't know very well, but who had great influence on me through their writings and so forth, such as W.E.B. Du Bois and Carter G. Woodson, whom I got to know, and so-called father of African-American history, and people like that. So that, I walked on the shoulders of many people. They held me up, and I was very flattered by the attention which some of them gave me.
You've written numerous books, sir. Is there any one particular book that stands out that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm not proud of any of the books that I've written. I'm best known for a book, The History of African Americans, called From Slavery to Freedom. But my favorite book of all the books that I've written is a book on George Washington Williams. George Washington Williams was a young African American who lived in the middle of the 19th century. He was born in 1849. He went to Western Pennsylvania. He reached almost early manhood at a time when it was very important in the 1850s, early 60s, but a time which, a situation which he didn't find any opportunities to be educated very early. So when he volunteers for the Civil War in 1863, he can barely write his name. He set his age up. He wasn't eligible in terms of age. He set his age up and took the name of one of the neighbors and passed himself off as an 18-year-old, which he was not. And he went in the army and served in several battles in Virginia and was wounded, discharged, re-enlisted at the end of the war in the 10th Cavalry and served out in what is now Fort Sill in Oklahoma. And there he also was wounded. He was shot in the left lung there, not in the line of duty. And there was a court-martial. I don't know quite what the results were, although I have the records of part of the court-martial. But he was discharged, and he then went to study at Howard University. He wanted to be a preacher. And he was admitted there, but things seemed to be a little slow there for him, so he quit there and went up to Newton Theological Institution in Massachusetts. Newton was one of the leading theological institutions in the country at the time. You must remember that this young man was almost illiterate, but he went there. He was not admitted. He appealed to the faculty and appeared before the faculty and pleaded his own case. And he was admitted not to the regular program, but admitted to what is called the English course, kind of a remedial program. And he did so well in that program that he, the following year, was put in the class with his regular classmates who had been admitted the year before. And he then went on and made excellent grades and graduated and was the spokesman for the class. He gave the commencement orations. He was ordained as a minister, and the rest is history. He became a minister. He then became an editor. He then became a politician, was elected to the Ohio legislature. And then he became a historian. He wrote a history of the Negro troops, a history of the Negroes in America, two volumes. Then he wrote History of the Negro Troops in the Rebellion. And he wrote many pamphlets and articles and so forth. And he became a prominent person in this country and became prominent abroad. His book was reviewed, first really major piece of writing of an American of any kind. He wrote two volumes, you see, and another volume, with big publishers and so forth. And so by the 1880s, he was kind of a toast of this country, admired greatly by people like W.E.B. Du Bois, who was just getting started, admired by others. And indeed, he got interested in foreign affairs. He was appointed United States Minister to Haiti. He was confirmed by the Senate and then not permitted to go because of some scandals brewing about him. And he was not, his commission to go to Haiti was withheld. Then he got interested in Africa and in the various imperial activities in Africa. He went to Belgium, became acquainted with King Leopold of the Belgians, and then he wanted to go to Belgium, the Belgian Congo, to look into matters there.
he did go, thanks to subvention by Collis Huntington, the great railroad magnate. And he got over there and found out how terrible conditions were and how responsible he felt Leopold of Belgium was for these terrible conditions. And so he wrote an open letter to Leopold, the King of the Belgians. He called him everything. He wrote a report to the President of the United States on what he had found in the Congo. And he then had shot his bolt there. Collis Huntington withheld support from him from that point on. He went around the Cape and up the west coast of, I'm sorry, up the east coast of Africa to Egypt, where he lectured before the Egyptian Geographical Society. Then he took a boat back to England, and on the boat he met a young woman. He had been married, but he'd separated from his wife, and probably not divorced. I can't find no proof of divorce. But he took up with an English woman on the boat, on board ship, and they sailed on. They arrived in England together. Then he got sick in London, and this English woman took him to Blackpool for the sea air, and he died there with her. She didn't die, but he did. She was prostrate for days in mourning. But he was 41 years old. He'd done all that by that time. His body was not brought back to this country, and he was buried in Blackpool, England. I followed him. I began to follow him in the early 1940s, and I followed him off and on, did research on him for 40 years, and I published a biography of him in 1985, and it was reviewed widely. It was published by the University of Chicago Press. It was later republished by the Duke University Press, still in print, and it's my favorite book.
Dr. Franklin, we're here at the 18th Annual Human Sweat Symposium on Civil Rights in Austin, discussing Brown versus Board of Education, its 50th anniversary. But to get from Plessy B. Ferguson in 1896 to 2004, the 50th anniversary, can you connect the two, Plessy with Brown v. Board?
Oh, sure. Plessy, which is a case that came up in Louisiana in 1896, came to the Supreme Court, was a case in which Plessy, who looked like a white man, and they knew he was, but they knew he was not legally white in Louisiana. When he got on the train in New Orleans, going some distance there in Louisiana, he was told that he had to sit back with the black people, and he said that he wasn't going to sit back there, and they arrested him, and he was charged with trespassing and violating the law, and he took the case to the United States Supreme Court finally.
The late John Hope Franklin, noted historian. Franklin died on March 25th, 2009. He was 94. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You're going to hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard,
Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
We don't want you on our team. You're too slow and fat.
This is weight bias.
Don't you care how you look?
Those with the serious disease called obesity face weight bias every day.
You're not the right fit for this job.
And blame themselves.
I wish I was different.
Weight bias hurts.
Let's stop weight bias.
Be part of the solution.
Go to stopweightbias.com. A public service message from Obesity Action Coalition.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-sided word.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history. Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades Global Edition. One song per decade, 100 years of music in 1 hour. Get ready to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruising the Decades, Brad Savage. Brad Savage.
Lend me your ears. I'll play you some records. 100 years of music on Cruising the Decades. This is episode number 141, CruisingTheDecades.com. And on today's show, wartime patriotic songs of World War I and World War II. Plus, we find time for a little love in your heart. Remembering Roberta Flack, David Johansen, and Joey Mulland of Badfinger. And a humdung dinger from Dingersville, plus a double dose of Doris in the 1950s. Cruising the Decades begins over 100 years ago in 1917. A very popular song from the World War I era that was actually originally composed for voice and piano. This was a sheet music song at the dawn of the recorded music era. Sheet music sales actually outsold recorded music as it was a brand new technology. Well, then the popular version of this song came out in late 1917. This song is from Helen Clark and Chorus, a real patriotic tune. What kind of an American are you? On Cruising the Decades.
With all your might, what kind of